I titled this section of Scripture, which is only three verses, Zechariah chapter 10, verses 5 to 7, that the Lord's going to bring Israel back and they're going to prevail over their enemies. They will prevail over their enemies, and they have. And that's what I'm going to show you this morning. The text in the New or the American Standard of 1901 reads, "And they, the Jews, shall be as mighty men, treading down their enemies in the mire of the street in the battle, and they shall fight because Jehovah is with them. The riders on horses shall be confounded, and I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them back, for I have mercy on them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am Jehovah their God, and I will hear them. They of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and the heart, their heart shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it and rejoice. Their heart shall be glad in Jehovah." Now, in our previous section that we looked at last week, we saw that the Greeks had persecuted the Jews, and the Jews were going to prevail over the Greeks. And it was specifically laid out that these were the Greeks that were doing this, and it was divine retribution. So this section of Scripture that we started last week and moving forward will go over what we call the latter days, the latter days. The latter times began with World War I. and I don't want to go into that today, but I have substantial documentation from other messages that we've done, and I can give you that if you're interested. The Jews prevailing over their enemies is because God is with them, not because of any military prowess on their own. They've won so many battles that it has to be that small country has something more than just their own military prowess. Remember, my father was in the Second World War, and he told me, he said, for the first few years of the war, everybody thought Germany was going to win. They were so powerful. We thought they were going to invade Britain. The Battle of Britain was over. And then something happened. He said it was just, my father wasn't a believer at this time. He said, something happened. It was outside of this earth. I don't know what happened. The Germans didn't invade. The Germans backed off. They started doing things that were totally inconsistent with the military prowess they had. And Britain became superior. He said that just didn't make any sense. Hitler started making some very stupid moves. But the fact remains is, against all odds, the Allies won. The tide turned. The tide turned. Well, against all odds, the Jews are back in the land. They're prevailing over their enemies. Now, the text here says that the invaders on horses are going to be confounded. And the Israelites are going to prevail over them in battle. You know, God says, I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them back. Meaning, I'm going to bring them back to their land after the diaspora. It started eventually in 722 B.C., and it really, really got going in 586 B.C. when the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem. And he says that I'm not going to cast them off anymore. At some point in time, I'm not going to cast them off. Now, he's referring to Judah and Ephraim and Joseph as the whole state of Israel. Because if you remember, after Solomon, roughly 931, there was a civil war and they divided. And so they were called two separate countries for a long, long time. This lengthy period of the latter days when these things are going to happen that is being discussed here. Someday, there's going to be a final restoration in belief where the whole nation believes that Jesus is the Messiah. And Paul tells us in Romans 11, and then shall all Israel be saved. The entire country is going to be saved. Bringing the Jews back has been a very gradual process. It started in the 19th century with a successful movement called the Zionist movement. And it's going to end when all Israel is saved and they enter the millennial kingdom under King Jesus, but in belief. Because they're not back there in belief now. There are some that believe Jesus is the Messiah, but most of them don't. So they're back there in unbelief. But they're back. Just like God said, they will be back. Now, the Zionist movement started in the late 1800s. Excuse me. There was a lot of people writing about the Jews' need for a homeland, but the guy that did it the best was an Austro-Hungarian journalist named Theodor Herzl. He's known as the father of the modern state of Israel. And he wrote this book titled The Jewish State, and he talked about the need to bring the Jews back from all around the world to the homeland, and other people were writing at the time. God was inspiring these people to start writing. And there was a group in Great Britain called the English Zionist Federation, and they were founded in 1897, just a year before Herzl wrote his book. And they were trying to do what Herzl had been talking about, and that is to do a grassroots movement to capture the communities, to start reaching out to people, make this practical. Let's just not write about it. Let's make it practical. And so they were trying to organize the Jews. Chaim Weizmann was instrumental in this. He really got on with it. He was a PhD scientist. He had invented, I think it was acetone, was used in armaments in the First World War. I think he won a Nobel Peace Prize for it, too, or some Nobel Prize or science or something. But whatever it was, he was a real worldwide scholar, one of the founders of Hebrew University. He gathered a bunch of people together in 1913, and he was trying to push this. It wasn't going very far with the intellectuals, and I put their names down in your notes there. These guys are famous in Israel today because of this, and Britain. But Herzl had this, let's go in through the back door here. Let's get the grassroots going. Let's get the people. Let's make this practical. And that was where Weizmann came in. Weizmann was a very practical, scientific guy, and knew if we had a strategy, if we had a methodology of pushing the people, pushing the Jewish people to say, look, we need a homeland. We need a homeland. And we need more than thinkers. We need doers. You know, there's plenty of thinkers around that don't do. And once you get the ideas out there, though, you need an army of people to actually do something. What changed the situation was Turkey came into the First World War on the side of the Germans. That just changed everything. And on November the 9th, 1914, Herbert Henry Asquith, H.H. Asquith, he was the Prime Minister of Britain. He made this statement in a speech there. He says, oh, Turkish Empire's committed suicide now. It's all over. Now, if you remember from our study on the different caliphates of Islam, this was the last caliphate, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and they subjugated that area of Israel that was called Palestine at that time. And they became now a target for dividing their territory up because they had a huge caliphate. It was the last one. And as a result of losing World War I, their territory was divided up. In 1915, there was a man from the cabinet in Britain, Herbert Samuel, and he circulated a memo to his other folks in the government talking about the need for a Jewish homeland. He didn't say the time was right now, but he said, we need one. But in 1914, it's interesting, as Weizmann started having regular meetings, because he had international prominence in the scientific community, he easily got in to talk to these guys. He started meeting with Samuel, Balfour, and Lloyd George, the prime minister, because of this memorandum that was circulated by Samuel and because of the fact that Weizmann was famous and the grassroots efforts in Britain started making this national news, and it got into the newspapers and people were talking about it. So in 1917, in June the 9th, this guy named Lord Rothschild, an enormously wealthy Jewish financier, saw Weizmann and Rothschild told Balfour that the majority of the British Jews were in favor of a homeland. And Rothschild was asked by Balfour to draft a declaration. Balfour says, okay, I'll write a declaration. You draft it. So he drafted it. Balfour sends this declaration to Rothschild saying that the Jews need a homeland. Now, this thing has been preserved in the Independence Hall in Britain, in Tel Aviv, and it's a famous document. That was the foundation document, the Balfour Declaration for the Jews getting a homeland. It was written by Balfour, it was approved by the War Cabinet, but it was addressed solely to Lord Rothschild. Churchill agreed. Churchill was a friend of the Jews. And during World War I, Churchill was chief sea lord, as it were. He's head of the Navy. Head of the Navy in World War I. He was all in favor of it. He thought it was great. And when Allenby, General Allenby, marched into Jerusalem on 1914, liberating Jerusalem, Churchill saw this as paving the way for the Jews to have a homeland and go back. And that's another famous event. That this picture's all around Jerusalem about him coming in that parade, victorious, liberating Palestine, if you will, liberating Jerusalem from the forces against the Allies and the Ottoman Turkish Empire. I want to talk for just a couple minutes, though, about a few prophecies in the Old Testament that specifically lay out this restoration of the Jews. I'm going to read one of them, and then I'll just reference a couple of them. Ezekiel received several significant prophecies about the Jews coming back. The largest one in chapter 37 we call the Valley of Dry Bones prophecy, and it is a prophecy that talks about the restoration of Israel after being dead. That prophecy, while it's very important, is actually about the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the millennial kingdom when they come back and believe. There are other prophecies in Ezekiel that talk to them coming back before they experience the national repentance, because they haven't had a national repentance yet. One of these is going to be looked at. I'm going to do Ezekiel 20, verses 33 to 38. I misspelled one also here. I put the book of Zechariah down. It's actually Zephaniah. Zephaniah chapter 2, verses 1 to 2. I'm going to read the Ezekiel prophecy. It's a little bit long, but bear with me here, because it makes it real clear. As I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, surely with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out will I be king over you. And I will bring you out from the peoples and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered, with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with wrath poured out. And I will bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there will I enter into judgment with you face to face, like as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So will I enter into judgment with you, saith the Lord Jehovah, and I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant, and I will purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the land where they shall sojourn, but they shall not enter into the land of Israel. And ye shall know that I am Jehovah. Now, God here is using this simile or this illustration of the Exodus to show them what he's going to do to them later on. And like he says, I'm going to do this in the future like I did it in the past. He led them out of a persecution in Egypt into the land of Canaan. They were rebellious in the desert. That's why they wandered for 40 years. God kept them there because they were so rebellious. There's only two guys that made it through that whole time in the desert from the original group that came out of Egypt, Joshua and Caleb. What do you think about that? They came out and there was over 1 million of them coming out of Egypt. Two out of all of those folks that came out because they were so rebellious. None of the others came out. All their progeny came, to be sure. I mean, that's why the book of Deuteronomy was written. It was a retelling for this new generation. This new generation. Much in the same way that God led them out of the persecution, he's declaring, I'm going to do it again. And if you look back in time, this prophecy was given in the 6th century B.C. And it's clear that he's already done this today. Already done this today. God says, I'm going to bring you out from the people and gather you from the countries, plural, from the countries of the world. And Ezekiel's text says that they're going to be gathered out of wrath and for wrath. You know, they've been persecuted in the countries in which they lived, and they've been judged severely because of that. Now, when God says with an outstretched arm, that is a idiomatic phrase for, I'm harming you, I'm correcting you, I'm persecuting you. It's not an outstretched arm with a hand open giving them something. It's a fist clenched. The most serious judgment that he brought against them of all times was the Nazi Holocaust. 6 million of them died in those ovens and other means in the Nazi Holocaust. 12 years that went on, 6 million of them. Now, this set the stage for world sympathy, and that led them to becoming a nation, even though they were regathered in unbelief. This is where the Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 1 to 2 comes in. Because that text says that they were gathered with no shame. They don't have any shame. They don't have any shame. They haven't accepted Christ as their Messiah. And we can see from this passage that this mighty hand and this outstretched arm is coupled with wrath poured out. So you can see what he's talking about here. Wrath poured out. He gathers them out of wrath, the Nazi Holocaust. That's what provided the political impetus in this world for them to come back to the land of Israel. People felt sorry for him. They were willing to do something for him. So he brought them into the land as a sovereign nation. Sovereign nation. World War I had the effect of concluding the Zionist movement and giving them more impetus to come back. World War I ended, and the Jews were coming back under the Zionist movement, and Allenby comes in all his glory into Jerusalem, and the Jews are going to come back. So World War I was very instrumental. World War II was even more instrumental because it brought them back as a sovereign nation. A sovereign nation. Now, the persecution that's coming out of wrath, the Nazi persecution for wrath, is the persecution that will happen under Antichrist. starting at the 3.5-year period in the Great Tribulation, the Antichrist is going to start the greatest worldwide persecution of the Jews that this world's ever seen. 1/3 of them died under the Nazi Holocaust. 2/3 are going to die under Antichrist persecution. And after that final wrath, they are going to turn to him and accept him. From the Nazi Holocaust to the Great Tribulation, there's going to be a period where they reside in the land, but not regenerate as a nation. In other words, God's not going to be their God. Christ is not going to be their Messiah. But God says, nevertheless, I love you. I've made promises to the patriarchs of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and I'm going to do this for you because I said I would. God's promises are always kept. There's no exceptions. He always does what he said he's going to do. So the Second World War was, like the First World War, instrumental in providing a major step to them coming back to the homeland. But now it's a sovereign country. Now it's a sovereign country. They are seated on the United Nations. They are negotiating with other countries. And little teeny Israel, not even the size of New Jersey, has got political prominence in the world. And they're always in the news. Always in the news. After the United Nations voted to give Israel statehood on November the 29th, 1947, five Arab armies made announcements that they were going to stop it. They were going to wipe the Jews out. Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, and they immediately invaded in 1948. Now, the stated purpose of this invasion was to push the Jews into the sea. Now, even though that this November the 29th of 47 declaration was made, they didn't declare their independence until May the 15th of 1948. And it was right after that the Arabs attacked. There was a man named Hassan Pasha. He was a secretary general of the Arab League. And he declared their intention. He says, hey, this is going to be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre that's going to be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. What Hitler didn't finish 3 years before, we're going to finish. I mean, these were public declarations that were in the newspapers all around the world and all the media. There wasn't any secret about this. And there was a Nazi collaborator named Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was a leader of the Arabs during the British Mandate. And that was the time that Britain controlled the area that was called Palestine from the end of the First World War when Allenby came in until they were declared a state. He was charged with the Nuremberg trials, but he escaped. And he actively supported Hitler's policy to exterminate the Jews in World War II. And he was very, very vocal. Very, very vocal about exterminating the Jews. There wasn't any secret about it. Like, the media today just downplays all this stuff like it's just, you know, two countries over there having some disagreement. It's not two countries having a disagreement. They were far more open about it back then. But despite the disadvantages in numbers, organization, and weapons, the Jews took an early initiative. They knew they were going to declare independence. About a month before, actually 6 weeks before, they started capturing a lot of towns. The Haganah, which was a big Jewish group, military group, they captured Tiberias and Haifa, and they temporarily opened the road to Jerusalem. No one would give them any weapons. They didn't have the means of manufacturing any weapons. They didn't have the money to buy weapons. Czechoslovakia was the only country that gave them weaponry, and it was old World War II or World War I used weaponry. God wanted them to survive, and they beat back all of these other countries that were coming in. They allowed them to capture everything that the Arab aggressors were trying to take from them. Jordan began to be called Jordan, because before that they were called Transjordan. They captured this area that became known as the West Bank. There is no such thing as the West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. But that is the politically correct term because of the Arabs that's been applied to this. Now, you have to understand, and I think we know, we realize this, that the Arabs are vastly superior in numbers and geography, and they control the world's oil. So people bow to them and do what they want so the oil doesn't get cut off. Egypt captured what was known as the Gaza Strip, and that was the land of the Philistines in old times, right in the south and west of Israel. Both countries, Syria and Egypt, they expelled or they murdered every Jew that they could who was living there. And during the 19 years that Jordan and Egypt occupied those territories, excuse me, it was Jordan and Egypt, not Jordan and Syria, or Egypt and Syria, they called them occupied territories. And they started calling the people Palestinians that were Arabs in Israel. Now, Israel said to the Arabs that were living there, you can stay here and you can become citizens of Israel. Or you can go to the other Arab countries, and they're all around here. You can go to anyone. It's fine with us. Well, the Arab countries wouldn't let them in. And these were people that wanted to get out. So you got people that want to get out, and the countries that were supposed to be with them wouldn't let them in. They put them in these internment camps, and they said, they continued to offer them citizenship. Some of them did become citizens. Some of them sit in the Knesset, the government. There are Arabs and Muslims in the Israeli government. But this group that wanted to be there, that were in the former named territory called Palestine, wanted to get out. The Arab brothers, so to speak, wouldn't let them out, and that just turned into a pressure cooker. A pressure cooker. It was terrible. The Jewish areas in the Arab states were desecrated. They took their graves and they broke them down and turned them into latrines, and they took the gravestones and they were paving roads with them. They stole their homes. They killed them. The ones that they couldn't expel or the ones that didn't leave. There were a group of Ashkenazi Jews at the time, mostly Ashkenazi Jews, and those are the Jews from Europe. The German Jew, if you will, the Ashkenazi Jews. But there are more of those than there are the Sephardic Jews. Sephardic is the Hebrew language that is spoken now. But the Ashkenazi Jews welcomed all the Jews in. Come on, come on, come on. They just had a hard time getting them in. And Israel never had a policy of expelling any Arabs at all. Whereas the Arab countries were killing the Jews that stayed there. In 1949, a year later, Israel signs an armistice agreement with Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Transjordan. They won the war against all odds with World War I used weapons from the Czechoslovakians. And again, nobody would help them. Even though Harry Truman and Stalin both affirmed them and set up trade relations, or at least let's have a treaty, let's have relations. They recognized them as a nation. It didn't help them. It didn't help them. Britain and Pakistan recognized the annexation of Judea and Samaria, which came about after this. But that region became a source of many, many terrorist attacks. In 1945, there was about 870,000 Jews living in the surrounding Arab countries. The Muslims called them Dehmini. Dehmini. If you live in a Muslim country, and if you don't confess belief in Islam, they can either kill you according to their own rules, or they tag you with the term Dehmini, meaning you're going to pay an enormous tax, jizya, and you may or you may not be persecuted, but you will serve Islam. And as I mentioned, their real and personal property was confiscated. Yemen, Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Iraq had anti-Jewish riots. Zionism was declared to be a crime in Iraq. And about 600,000 Jewish refugees left those Arab states when they could get out, and they came into Israel. They became full citizens. But the Arabs stayed as refugees that wanted to get out of Israel, not because of Israel, because the Arabs wouldn't take them. There's an interesting book by Joan Peters called From Time Immemorial. She wrote this book probably 25 years ago or so, and she was a freelance writer, and she was offered a contract. And I can't remember who it was with. It was either Random House or Simon & Schuster, one of the big publishing companies in New York, to write the story of the poor Palestinians. And she was pretty much a liberal, and she was willing to do it. And she said once she got in it, she found out there weren't any poor Palestinians. It was their own people that were subjugating them. She went back to them. She said, I can't take your money. I can't write this. That's not what's taking place. And they said, ooh, better story. Write that. Write that. So she did. It's a fascinating read. Absolute fascinating read. And continuing on. On May the 15th, 1967, Egyptian President Nasser, I know some of us remember him, he ordered a blockade of the Straits of Tehran. And that cut off Israel's southern access to the Red Sea, and their trade now, which had been developing, was going to go south. So Egypt moved, now listen to this, 100,000 troops, 1,000 tanks, 500 heavy guns into the Sinai Peninsula. And on June the 4th, the Arab forces outnumbered the Jews 3-1. This was Israel's six-day war. It was fought on three fronts against three countries in three overlapping stages. You got Syria up in the north. You got Jordan in the east. And you got Egypt in the south. West. Israel engaged the Syrians in the north. They beat them all. On June the 5th, 1967, the Israeli Air Force destroyed almost the entire Air Force of the Egyptians. They had 300 planes. They did this in less than a few hours. Israel's armored divisions under General Ariel Sharon launched this lightning attack in the same day and wiped out 800 Egyptian tanks. Now, these statistics that I'm giving you are commonly referred to from the publications at the time. A lot of this came from the Egyptian press at the time. Thousands of soldiers were taken. The Arab soldiers were taken. Nasser later acknowledged that 80% of the Russian-supplied military equipment had been lost. Finally, on June the 8th, he accepted a ceasefire. A ceasefire. The Jews won again against all odds. Against all odds. 3-1. Now, from 1948 to 1967, Jerusalem was a divided city, because the Jordanian troops had dominated the eastern side of Jerusalem in the last war. They were blowing up synagogues. They were destroying any vestige of Jewish life that they could just to try and irritate the Jews. They just would not stop. When we were there in February, we were walking around the old city. You can still see the bullet holes in the gates where the fighting was taking place. They're big holes. These are big bullets that these guys shoot. These are not little bullets. Israel notified King Hussein that they had no intention of attacking his country. Hussein, he believed Nasser's lies, and he said, nah, I'm gonna, I don't care. I don't believe you guys. I don't believe you guys. Well, the paratroopers, the Israeli paratroopers, they landed and they attacked from the Mount of Olives, which is on the eastern side of Kidron Valley, and they came in going westward, and they captured Jerusalem. They captured Jerusalem. They got to the Lion Gate. They entered it. And, boy, there was a lot of very, very happy people. They were praying on Mount Zion. They were praying on the Temple Mount. They saw Herod's stones, the Western Wailing Wall. Boy, it was an extremely emotional time for these guys. They captured it. And they had preserved it. They preserved it. These sites were not destroyed in that war. They weren't destroyed. They also took back the towns of Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Bethlehem, and Hebron. Now, Egypt's ally in the north was Syria. And Syria controlled a high elevation called the Golan Heights. And in controlling this, the high height of this area here, they had the military control of that area. And they've been harassing farmers and fishermen for 19 years, shooting at them, picking them off, irritating them. They held the high ground here. And the Russian people that were, or the Russian government that was fueling the Arabs' military equipment were helping out the Syrians. And they helped them fortify it. The battle for the Golan Heights was a tough one, but they won it, and they took it back. They took it back. The Israelis, or excuse me, the Arabs had planted a bunch of mines there, and the paratroopers of the Israelis landed behind the Syrian lines, and they started fighting back towards the Galilean region from the other side of the Golan Heights. They won again. Syria accepted a ceasefire on June the 10th of 1967. The Israelis won against all odds. The Six-Day War left 700 Israelis dead, 2,500 wounded, and there weren't any Arab casualties that were published, but people estimated about 15,000. As a result of this and the other two wars, if you will, Israel has been now given the status of a major military power. But the opposition now starts calling them occupiers. So they think we're going to win the battle in the news. We're going to lie about them. And the battle in the news has been going on ever since. The propaganda. Israel eventually returned the Sinai to Egypt. Some of us were here when that happened in 73. Anwar Sadat, Menachem Begin, made a deal. There will be peace. Israel is going to be recognized by Egypt as a country and give us the Sinai back. We'll make a deal. Well, that cost Sadat his life because his people assassinated him for doing that. Israel, though, remains in control of the Golan Heights. They're not going to let that go. It's a buffer zone, and without that control, they're going to be really, really vulnerable up there, you know, really vulnerable, and the terrorism continues. It's on the periphery. There's very little terrorism taking place in Egypt, or in Israel right now, because you've got the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, you've got the Shin Bet, which is equivalent to our FBI. You got police everywhere, the army's everywhere, and it's kind of interesting. They walk around with these brown uniforms and carrying submachine guns. That's all they need. all they need. And then you've got the Mossad, which is like the CIA. And I read recently that there was someone who wanted to bomb one of the shopping centers that we went in and bought different things, and just on the southwest side of the old city called Mamila. And before the guy could even pull his armaments together, all of these collective forces of the Israeli police, military, espionage, and so on, got him before he ever, and they took him to jail. You know, Israel, as the text says, is dwelling securely. They're dwelling securely. It's a miraculous story. In 1973, in an effort to force Israel to surrender the lands that they had taken, that the United Nations gave them, Egypt and Syria jointly attacked Israel in what we call the Yom Kippur War. Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. It's their highest holy holiday. There's no transportation. There's nothing taking place in the whole country. Everything's shut down. And they attacked them. There was severe loss of human life and equipment. Egypt refused to accept the ceasefire that the Jews had offered them, and a Soviet airlift to the Muslim states. The United States did send an airlift to help them from President Nixon at the time. And I want to just relate one miraculous story. It's just amazing the things that have happened to that little country, because God said, "You're coming back. You're coming back." Just like he said in way back to Ezekiel, 6th century. Again, to Zechariah in the text we looked at today. And this section of Zechariah was written about 485 B.C. During the Yom Kippur War, there was a group of Jewish soldiers that were in the Golan Heights, and they realized that there were landmines all over the area. Now, the procedure for getting a landmine out is they take these bayonets and they start really slowly putting them into the ground at a level that's just slightly raised, like maybe a 10-degree angle. And then when they touch it, then they'll gradually take the sand away and the ground away, and then they'll defuse it. Well, they knew that this was really going to cause them a lot of time to do that, and now they were really going to be vulnerable, which is exactly what the Syrians wanted. So, now, they weren't praying either. They weren't asking God for any help, but it was a cloudy night, and the clouds parted, and there was a very strong moon that night, and there was an enormous wind that came up. It blew the sand off of all of these mines, and the sun caused these metal mines to shine. They could see them all, and they just walked around them. This is a true story. This is a true story. I'm telling you, the more you know about this Bible and what has happened and what God is doing, the more solid your faith gets to see what he's done. See what he's done. After the Jewish victory in the Yom Kippur War, Saudi Arabia decided to retaliate. Now, they're the biggest oil producer over there. They decided to retaliate by shutting off the oil spigot to the rest of the world. And if you remember what happened back then, the embargo, it caused an enormous disruption in the world economy. You know, you think about, well, oil and all the cars are going to have a tough time with gas. That's only part of it. Industry shuts down. Now, at that time, there wasn't a big, there wasn't an ability to convert from oil to natural gas for all the industrial boilers, for the industrial processes. But they did. They made the adjustment after that, so they had a dual fuel capability. But up until then, they didn't have it. I mean, it caused a severe disruption. And the Arabs knew they had this power, so that's what they did. Now, in the years following that war, the Israeli enemies knew that they couldn't get them militarily. They're too strong. They're just, you know, God is behind them. God says, I am with you. I'm going to do this. You can't go against the God of the universe and expect to prevail. People do it. People do it. There's a lot of things that I put into your notes there that, you know, I'm not going to go over, but people were attempting to delegitimize the rights of the Jews to their ancient homeland. And the resolution that came about in the United Nations, that Zionism equals racism, of 1975 wasn't even revoked until 1991. Remember, God says, you're back. But you're back there in unbelief. You still don't believe me. So he's not going to make it easy on them. He's not going to make it easy on them. The Bible describes a war that the Israelis are going to engage in that's yet future to us. And the 38th and the 39th chapter of Ezekiel and describes this man whose title is Gog coming south from Russia along with a bunch of Muslim nations, Arab nations. And at least they are Germany, Iran, Somalia, Ethiopia, Armenia. And I've got a chart in your Bible there that I made up that shows the ancient names of these groups. But you can see what countries they represent. And those are the names of the people that were progeny of those that came from the Ark. Now, the text of Ezekiel 38 parallels the fifth verse of the 10th chapter of Zechariah that we read just a little while ago. And they shall be as mighty men, treading down their enemies in the mire of the streets of the battle, and they shall fight because Jehovah is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded. Ezekiel 38, verse 4, in the second half says, and I will bring thee forth, and he's talking about bringing Gog south, and all thine armies, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them handling swords. So the cavalry is going to be riding horses, and horses are not out of the equation here in the mountainous areas in these regions. And besides, that's what we call the cavalry. They're going to invade Israel from the north. Zechariah says the riders are going to be confounded. Ezekiel confirms this. The 21st verse, he said, and I will call for a sword against him unto all my mountains, saith the Lord Jehovah. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. And he's talking about the group that's invading that's coming from the north. Every man's sword is going to be against his brother. The invading army starts fighting each other, and they end up in a mutiny. You know, instead of fighting the Jews, they start fighting each other. They're confounded. They're confused. But God says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Israel, again, is going to be victorious because the text of the Bible tells us that Israel is not going to lose one person. Not one person. And all of the invaders are going to die, and they're going to become food for the birds of prey and the animals. I'm going to close with the few verses here from Ezekiel 39, from 23 to 29, where God says the reason he's doing all these things, and the nations shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity because they trespassed against me, and I hid my face from them, so I gave them into the hand of their adversaries, and they fell, all of them, by the sword. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions, I did unto them, and I hid my face from them. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, now I will bring back the captivity of Jacob, and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel, and I will be jealous for my holy name, and they shall bear their shame, and all their trespasses whereby they have trespassed against me, when they shall dwell securely in their land, and none shall make them afraid, when I have brought them back from the peoples and gathered them out of their enemies' land, and I am sanctified in them in the sight of many nations, and they shall know that I am Jehovah their God, and that I caused them to go into captivity among the nations, and have gathered them unto their own land, and I will leave none of them any more there. Neither will I hide my face any more from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith the Lord Jehovah. Amen.